This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Donna Lieberman joins us to talk about civil liberties infringements in the wake of the Ebola panic.
Fear has driven this phenomena. It's been exacerbated by the governors in New York and New Jersey. Ignorance is out there. Donna Lieberman adds some sense to the discussion.
Attorney Mara Verheiden Hilliard joins us to talk about the Cuban Five case and how journalists were paid to provide slanted coverage.
Three of the Cuban Five still rot in prison on a frame-up in Miami that should be unraveled.
We'll talk with Maya Shenwar about her new book, Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better.
She started thinking about this visiting her sister in jail in Chicago. Then she corresponded for 10 years with various prisoners. The ideas she comes up with for a better way are quite imaginative and important. The book Locked Down, Locked Out is one people should read.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
The Ebola quarantine protocol in the United States is bringing to the fore issues related to public health and individual civil liberties. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention has made clear that the Ebola virus is not contagious until symptoms appear. And even if symptoms are present, transmission of the virus requires contact with bodily fluids, such as blood or vomit. Given this, if you're suspected of having the virus but don't have any symptoms, can the state issue a mandatory quarantine? To talk about this question and related concerns is guest attorney Donna Lieberman, Executive Director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Welcome, Donna, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
What kinds of infringements on civil liberties are you seeing in light of recent media coverage of the Ebola virus?
Well, I think that what we're seeing is, you know, the rush to policies driven instead of by legitimate public health concerns, and Ebola is a legitimate, serious public health concern, policies driven by fear. You know, this is one example of where civil liberties and good medicine, like, are hand in hand. Good civil liberties policy that is policy that respects individual liberty and does not curtail individual liberty unless there's a really significant reason to do so and there's no way to sort of protect society without doing so. And with Ebola, you know, we don't object to quarantines under all circumstances. We really don't. There are some times when the public health requires that people, that society be protected from individuals who are infectious. And with Ebola as well. If somebody is contagious, it's okay to put them under quarantine. But if somebody is not infectious, does not pose a danger to society by virtue of their physical condition, well, then it's unacceptable. And so what we have been pressing for is, rather than the bully governor's approach, which is, you know, quarantine them all and better safe than sorry, is an approach that is in sync with what the CDC has proposed. The CDC understands the medicine, understands public health, and you know, people should be monitored, absolutely, if they are at risk for infection. But if they show no signs of infection, which means that they are not contagious or dangerous, they should not be quarantined. They should simply be monitored. And it's unfortunate, I think, that in the rush to fear-driven policies, which are also politically acceptable these days, a number of people have been forced to suffer. But I think that as the nurse, Casey Hickox in Maine formerly of New Jersey, involuntarily.
Are you a patriot? Right.
A temporary denizen of the parking lot in Newark. You know, as she dramatized so effectively, you know, we have heroes out there. Medical people don't go risk their lives to treat people who are facing horrific, you know, a horrific epidemic and then come home to sort of infect their friends. There are ways to do it. And I think the not so well addressed collateral damage of an overbroad quarantine policy is not just on the individual, and that's not insignificant, but on the discouragement that it generates to other medical professionals who want to go help wipe out this epidemic.
How do you see things going now? Is it quieting down or is it building up?
Well, I think that it's you know, it would be ridiculous for me to say it's quieting down just because there's been 1 day, 2 days without additional news stories. There are reports that the Médecins Sans Frontières, which is Doctors Without Borders, I just love saying the French name.
Yeah, I'm impressed.
And I have so much admiration for them, has actually redirected their teams to spend time in Europe where these quarantines don't exist and people can self-monitor rather than coming straight home. We still don't know, you know, whether there are people who have been forced into quarantine or not. You know, I'm delighted to report that the doctor in New York, Dr. Spencer, you know, his condition was upgraded, according to the media, to stable. That's good news as well.
Donna, there seem to be parallels between the Ebola panic and the response to the HIV virus decades ago. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is very much parallel to HIV. I think we know more about Ebola than we did in the early days of the HIV epidemic. But people just didn't know, and good people who didn't know were afraid. And it took a lot of a combination of both education and research for us to develop relatively sane policies. You know, there are still issues about compulsory testing, but I think that as we as a society have come to understand, you know, universal precautions, healthy behaviors by medical people and people who are infected are perfectly safe and healthy for society, and the stigma has declined as we have developed treatments that can help people live a good long time with HIV. You know, what's astounding is, you know, HIV was an epidemic in the United States. The response to Ebola is based on a tiny handful, a tragic handful to be sure, but a tiny handful of cases, and is really way out of proportion. And it also feels a little bit, there's this unspoken fear, you know, related to it coming from Africa here. It feels like there's a racial component to the fear, though I have no, it's just a feeling. Maybe I shouldn't say that.
Ebola, after all, is a river in the Congo. Right. And I think very much is a racial component of it.
There's, by the way, the public health policies, you know, the global health policies that have led to, you know, the stagnation of research into vaccines and treatment are just like, they speak volumes about how messed up our priorities globally and nationally are in terms of, you know, support for medical research and treatments.
Yeah, exactly. If there was money in it, there'd be a vaccine under development pronto. What kind of plans, if any, are you, as the head of the New York Civil Liberties Union, engaged in with other lawyers like yourself around the country to counter any of these irrational, fear-driven policies that lock people up?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we've been doing a number of things. You know, first of all, you know, quite honestly, we had to learn a bit about the medicine and the public health issues so that we could talk about what's an appropriate public health policy driven by medicine, not by fear. So we did that, and we've tried to speak out in the media when they have come to us or affirmatively help people understand the medicine tells us that you shouldn't be quarantining people unless they're symptomatic and infectious. And we've been sharply critical of the two governors in that regard. You know, some of the ACLU affiliates are pursuing Freedom of Information requests to find out exactly what policies are in place and to sort of document, you know, the impact of them. You know, we are pressing for the state of New York to relax its quarantine policies and make it a public health-driven policy rather than, you know, a fear-based policy. Governor Cuomo gets on the radio or TV and talks about the days leading up to Sandy, how we shut down the subway system. You know, better safe than sorry. We're not taking any chances. And that's a message that really flies. You know, I'm protecting my people. I have an awesome responsibility. But when the collateral effect of that is that people can't get from hither to yon, that's okay. It's a small price to pay. But when the collateral damage is that you're locked up in your apartment and you can't go out and your neighbors all suspect you of being somehow a dangerous person, and you lose your job is in jeopardy and your whole sanity is in jeopardy, you know, kind of equivalent to, you know, solitary confinement with a TV and a phone, then the collateral damage is much too great. So we have been really pressing to identify cases to find out if people are really being quarantined or whether this is just a policy that has not been applied, and to press them to really, you know, follow the best medical advice instead of the blunt instrument.
Donna, on that note, we'd like to thank you so much for your leadership on this and so many other civil liberties issues, and we look forward to having you back on soon.
Me too. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Donna.
Bye-bye.
Okay,
take
bye
it easy.
Guys.
Lately, Cuba and its relationship to the United States has been in the news. The New York Times alone had 4 editorials on Cuba. Several urged the reestablishment of diplomatic relations with Cuba, which were severed over 50 years ago. Another urged the prisoner exchange of the Cuban Five, now 3, and Alan Gross, the American, who's been in Cuban prisons for the last several years. Last year, attorney Mara Verheiden Hilliard and her colleagues at the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund filed a Freedom of Information Action lawsuit against the United States State Department for its refusal to produce responsive materials in its possession about secret payments by U.S. government officials to Miami-based journalists who were, quote, reporting on the Cuban Five case before and during the trial and while the jury deliberated. We welcome back attorney Mara Verheiden Hilliard to give us an update on the case.
Mara, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Last week, several of us were surprised to read a New York Times editorial calling for a prisoner swap between Alan Gross, the American government subcontractor, and 3 of the so-called Cuban Five. Can you give us a sort of nutshell description of the Cuban Five's case and where we are now with that?
Yes, the Cuban Five, or 5 Cuban men who came into the United States to basically learn what the terrorists in Miami were planning. Cuba is a country that has been subject to terrorist attacks for decade after decade. There have been bombings, planes shot down, you know, a huge amount of death and destruction, but it comes out of the United States from anti-Castro Cubans in Miami who are wreaking terror on the people of Cuba. And the U.S. government has never taken action to stop these terrorist attacks that emanate from their shores. And in fact, the CIA has been known to have had at least some of these people on their payroll or working with them over the years. So when it comes to the Cuban Five, these are men who risked everything to come into the United States, to blend into the community in Miami, and to try and find out what was being plotted against the people of their country. And ultimately, they uncovered information which was even shared with the FBI, from the Cuban government to the FBI, and what happened is the terrorists weren't arrested. These men were arrested, and they were charged with espionage offenses, and they were put on trial, and they were found guilty. And the issue here has become the fact, aside from the fact that these men should never have been arrested and tried to begin with, is that they were tried in Miami, tried in this heated environment, tried in conditions that there's no way that they could have gotten a fair trial, an issue that has been repeated over and over again in the years of appeals. But what has been uncovered more recently is that the U.S. government had journalists on their payroll who were presenting themselves as independent journalists in Miami who filled the airwaves and the newspapers with extremely hostile and inflammatory coverage of Cuba as well as the trial itself. And there's no way that this couldn't have had an impact on the jury, on the jury pool, on the sitting jury.
Legally speaking, what's wrong with the government doing that?
Well, on many different levels, it's extremely wrong. I mean, you can just start with the underlying right to a fair trial. I mean, you have the right, technically, to be given a fair trial where you're supposed to be tried by a jury that is not supposed to be influenced. The judge refused to sequester the jury in this case. And so they were obviously, you know, subject to a huge amount of influence in terms of the presentation in the Miami media. But when the U.S. government itself is funding reporters and not disclosing that these reporters are on the payroll, the reporters themselves are not disclosing that they are on the payroll, I mean, the government is influencing a trial and the atmosphere in Miami so significantly. The other issue is that the U.S. government itself is prohibited by the Smith-Mundt Act of 1948 from funding activities to influence and propagandize domestic public opinion. So they're barred by law from actually trying to undertake these kind of covert propagandizing, you know, endeavors in the United States.
You know, I thought one of the ironies in one of the New York Times editorials was when the Cuban government was referred to as a police state.
Yes, I mean, I think there's an awful lot of people who read that and were kind of scratching their heads. I mean, granted, we live in a country where we are free to be wiretapped, spied on, to have the FBI infiltrating religious institutions and monitoring peaceful protest, and sure.
Mara, what do you make of the fact that the Times and other newspapers seem to be covering Cuba and talking about some of the issues we've been discussing for years in the recent past?
Well, it's interesting because the Times has run several editorials in the very recent period addressing Cuba, and they've obviously made a decision that they wanted to present a very particular view about calling for change in relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Now, many of us, of course, have for years been arguing that there must be normalized relations between this country, that there should be an end to the blockade of Cuba, which, you know, year after year, the U.N. votes overwhelmingly that there should be an end to the General Assembly, that there should be an end to the blockade of Cuba. But the fact that the New York Times, which speaks with such an important voice when it's talking to those in the administration, is taking the step is I think many people feel that's very good. Whether or not we would agree with the formulations that they make in particular, or their characterization of Cuba, or their characterization of the Cuban government, is, you know, putting that aside, efforts that attempt to normalize relations are very important.
They talked about, as a prelude to normalizing relations, exchanging Alan Gross, and I want to ask you about what Alan Gross was doing in Cuba, but exchanging Alan Gross, who was arrested and has been in prison in Cuba now for about 4 years, exchanging him with the three remaining Cubans that are in Maximax prisons here in the United States. Talk to us about that prisoner exchange, would you?
Well, the prisoner exchange, the idea is that, as the Times has called for, is that the U.S. government could release the three Cuban men who are still imprisoned, as you said, and in exchange, the Cuban government would release Alan Gross, who was also in prison there. Now, politically and just factually, you just can't put an equal sign between the two of them. I mean, the fact is that the Cuban Five were not attempting to undercut or destabilize the U.S. government. They were simply trying to get information about terrorist attacks emanating from the United States, hurting the people of their country. Now, Alan Gross, on the other hand, was sent as part of a covert U.S. government operation into Cuba multiple times to deliver material, satellite phones, communication material, in an attempt to destabilize and overthrow the Cuban government. And there's always this sort of gloss put on it as if he was just helping the people of Cuba communicate. And, of course, everybody knows what this was. It was a covert destabilization operation by the USAID, who does that routinely, and they have contracts to do it.
Under American law. That's right. Been the law in this country, to try to overthrow the Cuban government, a law that Clinton signed in 1996.
That's correct. And so, aside from the fact that there really just isn't an equal sign between these two different events and why the people are, you know, in jail in the two different countries, again, that's really a question for the Cuban government. I don't think it's one that we, as people who are in solidarity with the people of Cuba or who seek normalized relations, can really weigh in on whether or not we think it's correct or not correct. It's really what the Cuban government would view as whether they consider it correct or not correct. But I think having the New York Times call for it, opening that door to the possibility, if that's something that seems like a good possibility as part of an effort to normalize relations, again, is a very important step.
Mara, what's happening in the case of paying the media? Did you mount a legal challenge to that?
We have fought for years with Freedom of Information Act demands, working in partnership with the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five, and Gloria LaRiva, who has led that organization, and she is really the person that worked so hard to uncover this issue. I mean, she is the key person and the National Committee to Free the Cuban Five that raised this issue, that spent huge amount of time going through records, going through the reports, going through the articles, going through the audio and visual of the different media, television, radio, and linking these together and doing research into these journalists and establishing what appeared to be this covert operation. And what we did, working with the National Committee and with Liberation Newspaper, was file Freedom of Information Act demands. We got a lot of material out, but there's a lot of material that was withheld. And you can see a lot of the contracts that we were able to get, and much of the material is up on a website called reportersforhire.org. But because the State Department was plainly withholding material within a certain time period and had not searched their records at all for the material that we had demanded from them, we filed a lawsuit in federal court, and that's a lawsuit we're still in the process of litigating.
How do you respond to the observation that there may be certain interests in the United States, like the travel interests or certain agricultural interests, that do want to normalize relations with Cuba and end the blockade of Cuba, but the policy of the United States in isolating Cuba and stunting its economy through the blockade, on the whole, that's been very effective in doing just that. And there may be people in the editorial board of the New York Times that want to change the policy, but the ruling elites in the United States as a whole don't want to and won't. What's your thoughts on that observation?
I think the issue of the blockade, which, you know, on its face, starving a population to try and force them to change their government is really criminal, and it's a violation of international law. And depriving people of the ability to receive goods, to sell their own goods. But, you know, on top of that, it's a political matter. If the argument is that Cuba is socialist and socialism is bad and socialism can't succeed, why would the U.S. government need to put their thumb on the scale so heavily? Let the country sell its goods. Let the country operate on its own. Let it operate fully within the political economic system that it has, and then see what happens. But, in fact, the U.S. government has never wanted to allow a socialist country to operate freely because, you know, standing on its own without the weight of the U.S. blockade, you know, Cuba would thrive. And I think when it comes to the issue of opening the blockade, there is clearly a split within, you know, the establishment, the ruling elites, as you reference, as to destabilization of Cuba. Clearly there are those who are thinking, because after all these decades, while they have hurt Cuba tremendously and hurt the people, hurting just the people of Cuba, at the same time, Cuba is still there, and that it has withstood and been strong in the face of all of this. And it's this hugely educated population. It has gone from, you know, extreme poverty to really providing for education, for, you know, providing doctors that go all over the world to help people. I mean, that's an amazing accomplishment. But the split within the establishment here in the United States is also thinking, and they've said it openly in the New York Times, that by lifting the blockade and allowing the U.S. to sort of penetrate into Cuba and penetrate into Cuba with American capitalism would be another way of attempting to overthrow the government of Cuba. So there's obviously that thinking going on, too.
Mara, I want to just step back a second in terms of the journalists. What are the journalists who are paid by the U.S. government doing now? Are some of them still reporting in Miami?
Yes. None of them were put in the position of being barred from reporting. The fact that these people present themselves as independent but are on the payroll of the government, in addition to whatever, you know, jobs that they have, apparently doesn't discredit them sufficiently from continuing in their jobs as journalists. In fact, there's $35 million annual budget for the Broadcasting Board of Governors and its Office of Cuba Broadcasting, which is the propaganda arm that puts out radio and TV Marti. And that's a lot of money that pours into Miami, pours into various funds of people who produce these shows and appear as journalists on these shows or commentators on these shows. It's a lot of money. And so that's the other thing, is that this has been a major, major funding stream for these groups and these entities in Miami who are working against the people of Cuba and against the government of Cuba.
So you're asserting they are still being paid?
Well, there are people who are taking money. That's what they were doing, is they would have contracts that the U.S. government would pay them. It's not necessarily that the U.S. government would say, here's a contract and I want you to write an article in the Miami Herald. It's that people were writing for various outlets and simultaneously also taking cash from the U.S. government through the BBG.
It's amazing. Looking into the future, there's been a lot of talk that Jeb Bush will be the Republican candidate for president. And I wanted to ask you what his connections are with these right-wing Cubans in Florida.
Well, I think with all politicians, you know, they have their finger to the wind. And the question is whether or not they feel that they have to pander to an extreme group because they think that that carries the day politically. I mean, if you stand up in Florida and speak in support of normalized relations, the issue is, are you just going to be run out of town? But, you know, increasingly the polls are showing that public opinion surveys are showing that, you know, in Miami, the newer generation of Cubans, really of Cuban Americans, have really don't share the extreme views of their parents, and that they want to have normalized relations, and that they are not necessarily hostile to the Cuban government and the people of Cuba. I think that's a really major factor that will sort of carry the day ultimately in American politics with regard to Cuba.
Mara, in addition to your efforts in the court system, what kind of people support do you see on behalf of some of these issues?
There's been such a sea change of support in terms of calling for the release of the Cuban Five, the fact that they didn't have a fair trial. Amnesty International came out with a statement. There's a lot of Nobel laureates who signed a statement calling for justice for the Cuban Five. Jimmy Carter has spoken out about the Cuban Five and saying that they should be released. Lawrence Wilkerson, who was chief of staff for Colin Powell when Colin Powell was Secretary of State from 2001 to 2005, has talked about the fact that the Cuban Five have been unable to They did not get a fair trial in Miami. So there are so many both well-known personalities as well as just everyday people who, when they learn about these issues and learn about the injustices, really feel that it's important that justice be done. And the fact is, you don't need the prisoner exchange. President Obama could give them clemency. He could decide that enough time has been served, that there are enough questions raised about the legitimacy of the federal government prosecution of these men and what occurred in Miami. And he could make the decision to release them and to let them go home to their families. But again, it's the political calculation. They would look at that simply in the context of the next election in Florida and whether or not they think that helps them or hurts them.
Mara, you referred to Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, a true insider in the Bush administration as Colin Powell's chief of staff. And I read the letter that he wrote to Obama, and I think we'll put it up on our website, lawanddisorder.org, so that listeners can read it. It's quite an amazing letter. You referred to it. And the thing that struck me in the letter was that he says to Obama, he says, the frame-up of the Cuban Five and their imprisonment was a payoff to the right-wing Cubans in Miami. He said, I know that, and you know that. And this is the word of an insider, so I think he knows what he's talking about.
And he does know. I mean, as you said, he was an insider. He knew what was going on. He knows what happened behind closed doors. And I think it's really such an amazing voice of his conscience that he's willing to tell the truth about what he, you know, understood happened and that there needs to be the righting of a wrong here.
Mara, if people would like to read more about what the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund is doing, how do they reach you on the website?
They can come to our website, which is justiceonline.org. It's justiceonline, all one word, .org. And there's information there about this issue, the Cuban Five issue, as well as other work that we do on civil rights and civil liberties and defending dissent.
Well, as always, it's a pleasure to have you with us, Mara, and we look forward to the day when we can talk about the Cuban Five being reunited with their families at home.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Mara.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In this country, there are 2.3 million prisoners, although the United States represents but 5% of the world's population. It locks up 25% of the world's prisoners. Our next guest, Maya Shenhwar, the editor-in-chief of Truthout, has written a hard-hitting and personal exploration of the enormous damage prison causes by severing millions of people from their families and communities, and the practical alternatives to incarceration that can create a safer, more just world. The struggle to end the prison nation is not an isolated fight, writes Maya Shenhwar in her newly released Locked Down, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. In her hands, and in a more robust context, the battle to topple the vast gulag that cages huge numbers of our fellow human beings is a fight to rethink what a good society ought to look like and what the good life might mean. Locked Down, Locked Out begins by examining the fundamental crises of how prison breaks apart families and communities. These experiences relay the enormous damages caused by severing millions of people from their family ties, their community ties, and it explores alternatives to incarceration.
Maya, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me, Heidi.
How did you come to write this wonderful book?
It started about 10 years ago, which was when my sister went to juvenile detention. I'd been corresponding with someone on death row, and I definitely had an inclination to write about this issue that at the time was really on the margins of journalism. But when my sister went to juvenile detention and I went to visit her, I was immediately struck by the fact that this detention center was a jail. 14-year-olds were being locked up. And I think it hits you all the more viscerally when they're children. I came away thinking, there is no good that could come of this. You're taking kids who've already experienced trauma, and this is true of adults, too. People who go in have already been traumatized as they're going into jail. You're taking people who've already been traumatized and putting them in the most isolating conditions, separating them from society in this way that can't help but create further trauma, not to mention, you know, the conditions that are present in jail, but just the act of caging people is putting them in a traumatizing position and isolating from their families who might motivate them to change. So that's what really sparked me to look in this direction. And the book, I think, is just a natural progression from that point. Unfortunately, my sister continued going to prison after that juvenile detention experience, which is pretty common. Most people who go to juvenile detention graduate to prison, so to speak. And in terms of my journalism, I started also looking in other directions and exploring how adult prison affects people and particularly affects families and communities.
Talk to us more about that, because we get the argument from the law and order folks about, well, there's violence in the society, and we've got to protect our safety, we've got to put these people away. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that that's just symptomatic of this automatic response we have, that if something's wrong, we need to use prison to address it. That's kind of our go-to answer. And the problem with it, I think, even if you have a complete void of empathy, the problem with that answer is that prison just doesn't work. About two-thirds of people who are released from prison are rearrested within 3 years. I don't always like to use recidivism rates as kind of a measure of success, because there are all kinds of reasons people get arrested and get incarcerated, and a lot of that is bound up with race and class. But if you're just judging by the system standards and assuming all the laws are in place for good reasons, people are doing the same things they did in the first place when they got arrested and went to prison the first time around. So it's clearly something's not working. One of the basic problems that can be presented to even people who are really averse to the idea of thinking about humanity is that hurt people hurt people. If when you're worried about crime, you're thinking about like actual harm and violence and dangers to society, you have to think about, well, what can you do that will actually prevent that from happening and will stop current harm and violence from happening? Well, we know, and there are scrolls and scrolls of research showing, that people who've been traumatized are more likely to create trauma. This idea that hurt people hurt people. So if you're putting people in a situation that just viscerally makes them angry, makes them hurt, makes them sad, you are, and also cutting them off from the people they care about, the people with whom they have positive connections and positive motivations, you're putting them in a situation that can only lead to further harm.
Maya, one of your points is that our prison system marginalizes not only offenders, but also the victims and their communities. How is that?
So in certain situations, and actually a lot of situations in which people are actually hurt, in the book I talk about a situation in which a woman's son is murdered. The case goes to trial, and it becomes clear after the man is convicted of murder, after the man who killed her son is convicted, that this woman does not want her son's killer to receive the death penalty. She feels strongly that she does not want to keep going with this process, that just the trial process, just being in court, is very hurtful to her. And also, she doesn't think that death is going to resolve this situation or to help her heal. Well, the prosecutor did not take that into consideration and actually became very angry with her that she was, you know, supposedly working at odds with him in this situation. The prosecutor continued to push for death. And I think that's kind of an extreme example of what happens in so many cases. And I'll use an example, actually, of this town in Montana, Flathead, where they've established a restorative justice program for all victims of crime. And the way the people there talk about it is that originally, you know, people would be in a situation where they'd be a victim of crime, let's say theft, and as soon as the theft happens, it's out of their hands. It's almost like the perpetrator versus the state, as opposed to, you know, a victim dealing with something that's harmed them. And in Flathead, whenever there's a youth crime, so it's someone under 18 who's committed a crime, the victims are actually contacted, and they're asked, would you like to participate in a restorative justice process as opposed to a legal process? So instead of talking about the law, we're going to be talking about the harm that was done to you, a very different thing. And so they're engaged in a process where the person who did the harm, in this case the theft, has to be accountable to the victim and the victim's healing. So I think there are a couple parts to this that aren't addressed in the current legal system usually. And one is that there needs to be really a victim-centric approach, something that takes the victim's healing into consideration. Because ultimately, the person who did the harm being convicted is not the ultimate point of healing for a victim. Once we take that leap and see the victim needs to be supported in all these ways that they know best, the law doesn't know best, you know, maybe they need counseling, maybe they want the person who hurt them to apologize, maybe they want some sort of reparations, maybe they want their community to kind of come forward and support them in various ways. And none of those things are allowed for in the current confines of convicting someone and sending them to prison.
Maya, your book is in great part about possibilities and alternatives to our unforgiving punishment system. One example we wanted to ask you to talk about is a poetry project that was initiated at Tams, Illinois, Supermax prison. Can you briefly describe what happened there?
What happened was there's a Supermax prison in Illinois. There was Tams. In this prison, men were incarcerated in solitary confinement, completely cut off from the world, in really what you'd say are torturous conditions. And the Tams Poetry Project was founded by some artists and activists, and the idea was to connect with people inside by sending them poems. And, you know, that would be a little something that could be done to kind of, like, give them a sense that the outside world cared. And so they began sending these poems to men in TAMS, and some of these people received their poems and were like, well, thank you for the poem, but why are you sending me a poem? I'm being tortured in here. So they started writing back, and they started saying, thank you for the poem, but help get me out of this torturous place. Is there some way that we can work together to advocate to change this? And so slowly this poetry committee started transforming into really a movement for justice and ultimately a movement to close TAMS. The people who were involved in the poetry project started collaborating with people in existing prison groups, and it just became this statewide coalition pushing for the closure of this prison that was really, I mean, at the time people were comparing it to Guantanamo, because that's the example that we kind of all have living in our minds of, you know, grotesque conditions. But this is happening in many places across the country. I mean, here I'm in California right now, and Pelican Bay, you know, there's the solitary confinement units there are similar in the way they set people in a position where you can't help but want to die. And so this movement went forward. The family members of TAMS prisoners became very involved. And ultimately, they were able to convince the governor to close TAMS. And so this is like a very clean-cut, no doubt about it, victory. And I think it's really inspiring that this type of thing, working with coalitions that unite people on the inside and the outside, can really make change.
We're speaking with Maya Shenhwar, who wrote Lockdown, Locked Out, Why Prison Doesn't Work and How We Can Do Better. Maya, the book starts off with you and your family visiting your sister Kayla, and then you talk more about how difficult it is just to visit people in prison, how cut off they are, really, through mail, through phone calls, and they get progressively isolated and more separated from their families and communities, and eventually kind of just are just out there alone. And I wanted you to talk about that process.
One of the things that sometimes gets lost in conversations about prison is the people. There's so often this focus on, you know, statistics, like everyone's constantly saying, the U.S. has less than 5% of the world's population, but 25% of its prisoners, or did you know there are more than 2.3 million people incarcerated, and that kind of thing. That's how people talk about mass incarceration. And also, you know, there's a lot of focus on corporations and, you know, money motivations behind prisons, and sometimes it gets lost that, like, every single person occupying a prison is a human being and therefore has, like, a constellation of connections with people on the outside when they go in. And prison kind of becomes this process of breaking each of those links. A lot of times people in prison talk about this as a very systematic thing, you know, that they almost can count. My mother sent me 20 letters the first month, but the second month she sent 15. And 3 months later she was sending 8. And it goes on like that, this kind of drifting away. I think it's certainly not the fault of family members usually, but it's the sense that as this person becomes more and more isolated and more kind of acculturated into prison, I guess, my experience is, for one thing, there's less to talk about. The person that you're writing to is not participating, you know, in the world. And it becomes kind of like this formality sometimes, writing letters. When the humanity is taken out of a person, it's oftentimes also taken out of a relationship. there also is the issue that, well, what are you doing? You're writing letters. You're kind of, even though I love writing letters, and I talk about that in the book, like, it's kind of one of my passions. When your primary form of communication is writing letters, you're kind of stuck 100 years behind the rest of the population of this country, and that in itself is a point of isolation, that the way you have to communicate with people is the way that most people in this country do not communicate. And because opportunities are very confined and restricted for visits and for phone calls, for example, when you're communicating with a person in prison, you can't call them, they have to call you. And you have no idea when they'll be able to call you. All that is controlled by the prison and kind of at the whim of the authorities there. So really, letters become the only reliable form of communication. And even those can be censored and delayed and all kinds of things. I think that one of the most important things to take away is that no matter how much you can kind of say, okay, I'm going to maintain good ties with this person that I love in prison, the system is up against you at every turn.
Maya, I wanted to ask you about alternatives. I edited a book recently, a book of imagination on what this society would be like if we didn't have capitalism. And one of the chapters was on what the justice system would be like. And the two people who wrote that chapter were Angela Davis and Mumia. And and they sketched out ideas of what community justice might look like. And I wanted to ask you about that, because if we can imagine getting rid of this awful and counterproductive prison system, what kind of system should we have? What can communities contribute? What kind of nurturing can we contribute? I mean, what do you have in mind when you ask people to imagine something different?
I think that word community is totally key, because as we approach justice right now, and I hesitate to even use the word justice for the system.
Well, Rap Rob used to say justice means just us.
Right, just us, exactly. I think that the first thing that we have to do is realize that we can never have some kind of monolithic system that will come in to replace prison. Some people will say, okay, prison's gone, what's next? As if there's going to be this new monolith. Some people say, oh, it'll be like a vast drug treatment system or something like that. It's like, well, most people in prison don't actually need that. So what can we do? And really, it does come down to the community level. It comes down to kind of erasing this idea we have that there is a one-size-fits-all solution to addressing our problems. I think, for one thing, we have to realize that so many of the problems that we currently categorize in the justice system, justice in quotes, so many of those problems stem from things we're depriving people of in our society, like housing, like food, like shelter. We have to think about providing those things as part of creating a society with less harm and less violence. That's integral. So even before we think about, okay, how are we going to mediate conflict and that type of thing, we have to think about how are we providing for people's needs, and not only their basic needs, although I think that's most important to consider first of all, but also, are we providing opportunities for fulfillment, opportunities for, you know, different ways of finding happiness? Because that's something I think that income inequality and racial inequality and all of these things definitely generate, is a society where certain groups of people have more opportunities for finding fulfillment and joy. And when you're less able to find fulfillment and joy, you're more likely to do things that might be harmful to others. So I think we have to think about all of those things. In terms of addressing what do we do when harm happens, when violence happens, and when there's conflict between people, I think the people who are best able to address that are the people in one's own community, and particularly the people that are close to the human beings involved in this conflict.
Maya, thank you. We really appreciated the time you took out there in California on your book tour to speak with us on Law and Disorder. We would hope that our listeners go out and get this book, Locked Down, Locked Out, by Maya Shenhua. Very important book.
Well, thank you. This has been great.
Thanks. Take care.
Take it easy.
You too. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.